this talk. So I think it's going to be probably a bit too fast if you don't know anything about conformal field theory. And it's probably going to be boring at some points if you already know conformal field theory. So I think hopefully it will be useful for people to refresh their memories about some basic points. But okay, let me then start. So what's a conformal field theory? So I'll be working mostly in the Euclidean signature. So I'll be considering an Euclidean quantum field theory in this dimension. And let me just to give you a picture or an equation for what I mean by this. So we'll have some path integral in some over some fundamental fields of some action that depends on the background metric and your fields of your theory, your matter fields, if you want. And we can to define the generating function of the correlation functions, we can deform with sources, right? So let me call these sources J. And we couple these sources to some, say, some local operators that you make out of the fundamental field, okay? So this path integral will be the partition function, so it will be our generating function of correlation. So the statement that the theory is conformal is a statement about an invariance of this effective action when you do a Weyl scaling of the metric. Okay? So the statement is that if you scale the metric by some factor, let's say, point dependent, okay? A scaling that depends on the position in space. And here, generically, so if this O is scaling dimension delta, you should also scale your current with the d minus delta. And so if you do this scaling, your effective action will be invariant. Okay. So of course this will descend to very interesting properties of the. It will relate correlation functions of this theory in two different backgrounds that are related by a Weyl scale. Okay. So, I mean, let me just write. So if you want to compute, say, this average of the operator O, of course, you just have to take functional derivative with respect to the O at X, with respect to the source, and then you set the source to this. And similarly, I'll use conventions when the energy momentum tensor is minus 2, so which is delta. Okay. So, as many of you know, this exact symmetry is often spoiled by anomalies, okay? So I'll put a bracket here. But maybe tomorrow I'll comment more about this, but for today, so the effect of anomalies is a limited one, so for most things, we can just really use the full this exact symmetry and proceed to see its consequences. Okay, but I should alert you to that since people here actually work on anomalies. So but this is just a symmetry that tells you it's not a symmetry in a precise sense. It's just something that tells you that if you know the theory in a given background, you know the theory in another background, okay? But if you want to actually solve the theory or have properties like have constraints for observable for the theory within a given background, you need to relate, you need to find symmetries within the same background, okay? So that, those are what are called conformal transformations. So conformal transformations are just coordinate transformations that leave the metric invariant up to a scale, okay? So if you have some, so if you have some coordinate x mu, you transform to some coordinate x tilde, and your metric. So from now on, let me. I'll stick to flat space for now on, or. So you have the standard Euclidean metric, and so this goes to. Under this coordinate transformation, this goes to a new metric, but you restrict the coordinate transformation such that this new metric is actually flat up to a conformal factor. Okay? So it's easy to see that this factor here, to the power d, is just the Jacobian of this coordinate transformation. So in D, greater than 2, the set of transformations that satisfy this property is finite dimension. And so I won't review the derivation of that, but I'll just state it very quickly. So obviously, if you do translations are preserve the metric, all Poincaré transformations preserve the metric. So Lorentz translations and rotation. So by rotation, I mean SOV rotation. So translations, I'll use the letter capital P mu for the generator, and for rotations, I'll use M mu, anti-symmetric matrix for the generator of the rotation. But on top of that, you have more. So you have dilatations, which I'll use letter D. So dilatations are just x goes to lambda x. So you, it's very easy to see. You just have omega equals lambda, preserve the metric. And you also have another set of transformations. It's called special conformal. And essentially, the best way to think about this is as an inversion followed by a translation, followed by another inversion. So what do I mean by an inversion? An inversion is simply the map x mu goes to x mu over x squared. Okay, inverts the radial coordinate, if you want. So if you do this inversion after a translation, what you have is x mu goes to, so first you invert x mu over x squared, then you translate, so plus and constant, and now you invert again. So you take this and divide by the square. Okay? So this also preserves the form of the metric after here. So let me just. Okay. So I'll use K mu for it. So, yeah, this is basically what I wanted to remind you about conformal transformations very quickly. So now I want to. Just quickly also for completeness, let me just make a comment. It's very easy to see that the set of conformal transformations, it's infinite in d equals 2. In d equals 2, so if you write the metric in complex coordinates, dz, dz bar, it's very easy to see that if you just now do a coordinate transformation, write z as some holomorphic function of some new variable W and V bar is some anti-holomorphic function or some new variable, some variable W bar, then the metric is just preserves its form up to a scaling. So it's very easy to see that you have an infinite dimensional freedom in this function to choose. But here I will be mostly focused in the higher dimensional case that in the beginning. That's the aim of our workshop. Okay, so now I want to discuss representations of this symmetry. So the logic was there was this symmetry. So now if you do coordinate transformations that just change the metric by a scale factor, you will have relation between observables within the same background with the same metric. So this will be a symmetry in a theory in a given background. So states of this theory will be organized in representations of this group. Okay. So now I want to study the representations, the unitary representations of this group. Yeah, so that's the being careful about the measure has to do with anomalies. So sometimes it's not actually possible to preserve. So even though this action is invariant under this transformation, the measure is not. This one? No, this one is not always okay. Sometimes it's anomalous. This is not a common source. Yeah, sometimes it's... Due to what? Yes, that's what I was saying. So the problem with the measure is this anomaly that I was. Not to bore you, I wrote down here the algebra of the conformal group. It's just So let me just comment. So the first two equations just tells you that these generators of translations and special conformal transformations transform as vectors under the rotation group. The dilatation transforms as a scalar under the rotation group. Then you have the standard SOD algebra. And then you have these other relations, other commutation relations between the dilatation and translation and special conformal. So tomorrow we will see that the full conformal group can be identified with OZ plus 1, 1, so Euclidean signal. So if you want S, if you want the connector part, yeah. Inversion, this will include inversions. So, where should I write? Right here. So, unitary unitary representations are irreducible. are the highest waste representation. So essentially, what you do is you. So there's a highest waste state. Well, in this case. Also called primary, that so first of all is a eigenstate of the dilatation operator. So I'll write the eigenvalue like that. Ah, I'm sorry. Before saying that, I should say another thing. Sorry, I'm jumping ahead. So one thing that I should comment is that now we're going to look for unitary representation. So you have to define what are the hermeticity properties that you want for your operator that should be implemented in this representation. Okay, so so what I'll choose is I'll explain afterwards is that. D is going to be anti-Hermitian. The Hermitian of P mu is going to be K mu, and vice versa. And Lorentz generators will be Hermitian. So why do I do this choice? So the idea is that when you have a Lorentzian theory, you want your generators to be Hermitian. So let me call A a generic operator. You want them to be Hermitian. Okay, so at time t, your Eisenberg operators to be Hermitian because they are observable. So this, in the Euclidean theory, actually goes to the fact that in Euclidean time, if you take conjugation, you go to A but at minus tau. You can, I mean, it's very easy to see that because if you define your operator A of T into the H T A in the Eisenberg picture, if you want. So let me put A Lorentzian here. I think it's A Euclidean. Right? So if you impose this here, and now here, A Euclidean of tau is you propagate in Euclidean time. So you get this relation. And now the other thing that we are studying here is that we want to study this theory in radial quantization in RD. Okay, so you want to think of RD. You want to think as evolution in radius as time. So that means that changing the sign of time corresponds to conjugating with the inversion. Okay. So A of A Euclidean of minus tau is equal to the conjugate with the inversion. So what you actually should impose for your generator is that A Euclidean should be equal to the Hermitian conjugated with the inversion. Okay, this is what you should impose. And that's precisely what gives you this. Because you see, we just saw that inversions change translations to special conformal transformations. Special conformal transformations were precisely defined like that. And a dilatation changes sign because if you're dilating and then you invert, actually you're shrinking in the other coordinates. And of course, this only acts on the sphere, rotates points on the sphere, and the inversion doesn't change that. So this is still Hermitian. So that's why we're choosing these Hermitian properties for the when we look now for the unitary representation.
can explicitly have effects on some functions of the transformation sector. And they will have also this property.
Yes, so these emission properties follow from the scalar product in shoes, if you want, inner product in shoes. So I'm saying that I want to study representations that that correspond to the inner product when you do this radial quantization. Anyhow, so that explains why there's this I here.
So it's an anti-Hermitian operator, so it has imaginary eigenvalues. So the other property is that this highest weight state forms an irreducible representation of the rotation group of SOD. So maybe I should put a label here. Let me put a label factor A. So this transforms, and there's some representation. So this is an irreducible representation of SOD. Okay? So this is your primary state. It's an eigenvalue, an eigenstate of the dilatation operator. And under the rotation, it transforms in an irreducible representation, okay? So it can be a spin one state, a spin two state, or whatever representation for SOD. And the other property is that it should be annihilated by K mu, okay? So this is the property that makes it highest weight, or in fact lowest weight. So the point is that if you look at this commutation relation, you see that acting with K mu on a given state lowers delta just by that commutation relation, and actually P increases delta. Okay, so since we want to have delta bounded from below, we have we impose this this condition of highest weight. So this is the highest weight state. Then the other states in this representation are what's called descendant states, and these are just obtained by acting with P mu many times, say n times, on the original primary state. Okay? It's easy to see that these descendants are still eigenstates of the dilatation operator. If you act the dilatation operator and now you commute it through with the commutation relation over there, you see that you simply get that the dimension is the dimension of the primary plus the number of times you acted with P. Okay, so this is the structure of the representation. So now I want to tell you about the constraints that these labels delta and this irreducible representation. So these representations are labeled by this delta and the irreducible representation of SOD that you choose here. Okay, let me call it R. So now, are they all allowed? I mean, you have to check that all states in this representation have positive norms. So that's a strong constraint that will constrain the possible values of delta and R. Okay. So to see that, let's look at the first level of descendants. So one constraint is that if I create the state, the first descendant, and now I take its norm, so, or even more general, let's say I take a generic linear combination of these states, and now I take the norm, this has to be positive, or zero at the most, okay? So what does this tell you? It tells you that the matrix, this matrix, O, it tells you that this matrix, if you think of it as a matrix like this, with two, with indices A nu and B mu, this has to be a positive matrix. It has to be, has only non-negative eigenvalue, right? These two statements are equivalent. This is true for whatever linear combination, is equivalent to saying that this matrix has to be positive. But now we can actually compute this matrix using the commutation relation. So first thing, you just replace this by K nu using the Hermitian properties that I just described. And now you use this, the commutation relation here. You can just replace K nu P nu by its commutator. And so the first term you get So D then acts on the primary, so you get 2 delta. And then you get and the second term. Is this correct? I think it is correct. It's just replaced by the commutator and you get this. So you see, now this is like the identity matrix in this language, nu, bnu. So what you need is that this matrix here, is to be, has to have eigenvalues. So let me call this matrix R A nu B nu, has to have eigenvalues bigger than delta. So let me even, what it means is the following. Delta plus the smallest eigenvalue of R A nu B nu has to be bigger or equal to zero. So now there's a trick that you can use to actually compute the possible eigenvalues of this matrix. So what you do, so first of all, this operator is really, now you can just use the action on the primary. So it's really, what you have there is really this representation of the generators sigma mu nu in the representation R, right? The representation R that defines the primary. So how do you write this? So you can use this trick. So I'll write this as the following. I'll write this as V dot sigma V simply equal to I delta, sorry. V mu nu alpha beta is the vector representation of SOD. Okay? So what it's something like nu alpha nu beta minus alpha nu beta delta nu alpha. And that definition of V dot sigma is just that. So this is a bit of a conceptual trick, so I'll have to explain that. Okay, let me just first write. So let me, this is the only non-trivial step, so let me try to explain. So first you have this. This is what? This is a generator of the group. So a generator of the group SOD is labeled by mu nu, this rotation generator, in the representation R, so it has A and B matrix indices. Okay? So now what I'm saying is that a trivial identity. I say, if I contract sigma, so if I define this contraction, V dot sigma, as this, so sorry, maybe I should put here mu nu and here V as indices, right? Mu nu. This is precisely the same thing as I got here, because this is just delta functions and this factor of two cancels. Okay? So I haven't done nothing. But now I change my point of view. So what is the new point of view? The new point of view is that written this way, what is this? This is V is, you should think now of indices, mu and nu as a vector representation, and alpha beta as the labels of the generator. Okay? So this is now a generator, alpha beta, acting on the vector representation. And so this construction, what it's doing is this summing over all generators, and sigma acts on a representation R, and V acts on a representation, a vectorial representation of SOD. So now this is just, you have the vec, you have a product of two representations, vector times R, and sigma acts on R, V acts on the vectorial representation, and you sum over all possible Lorentz generators of the rotation group, and this is a matrix you have. But now this is very simple to compute, as long as you think in this, as soon as you think in this way. Because now this is just, this is almost, you can express this in terms of Casimirs. Okay? So that's the basic point. Where should I write? So now you see, this sum alpha beta is sum over all generators. So that means that, I can write this V dot M as one half of what? V plus M dot V plus M minus V dot V minus M dot M. Sorry, where am I writing M? Sigma. Sigma and M are almost the same. That's why I wrote. You see? But now this is just the Casimirs in each representation. So the point is that now you can go to a basis where you diagonalize these Casimirs, and then it's easy to know what are the possible eigenvalues. So in other words, this equation here, or this condition star, becomes, so star turns into delta plus, so RAB is this, so it's one half of, so you want the smallest, so the smallest is just the minimum possible value of this Casimir. what is discussing is some representation R prime that it's inside the product, the tensor product of vector times the original representation. And this is just the Casimir of the vector representation, and this is just the Casimir of the original representation R. So this is bigger or equal to zero. So this is the generic condition that given a representation R, delta has to be bigger than this at specific size of constraint. Sorry, this is very simple in terms of equations, but conceptually, at least for me, it was a bit tricky. I hope I could pass the message of what we are doing in that trick. So, if you have questions, please ask. So let me just do the simplest example so that we see this more nicely. So let's do D equals 3, okay? So D equals 3, you have SO3. So everybody knows representations of SO3. They are labeled by a spin J, and the Casimir is just J plus 1. Okay? So the Casimir of the vector, sorry. Yeah, let me write R. Okay? R is labeled by J. The Casimir of the vector is just 2. And now what's the Casimir of R prime? So you see, you have to have a spin J representation plus a spin 1 or times a spin 1 representation. So the least you can have is a spin J minus 1. So this is just J minus 1 times J. So if, in fact, if J is greater or equal than 1, if J is smaller, then it's not that simple. So now you just plug it in there, and what you get is delta is greater or equal than J plus 1, I think. I think it's J plus 1. Any questions?
Well, this is not a unitary representation in the usual sense. It's something that is, well, because it's not a unitary representation of the group itself, because you're, in order to make it match with the big rotated version, you...
So it's unitary. It's really, this is the translation of unitarity in the Lorentzian theory to the Euclidean theory is what I'm saying.
Right, it's Lorentzian unitarity. But it's
right.
So it's not unitarity in the normal
the real unitarity.
Sense. Yeah. So is there some other group of which this is actually a unitary representation?
Sorry, I really think this is the usual sense. Well, unitarity in the Lorentzian case, that's the real unitarity where we live.
Well, I mean, you've defined a vector space, a Hilbert space, and certain.
You mean that I could look for representations where all these generators are emission from the beginning?
You could have done that, but I know you don't want to do that.
Yeah.
But I'm asking, is there some other group such that if you use that group, then this would be like that? In other, I'm just asking if this, how this could make contact with, if you wanted to describe to a mathematician what you're doing, you could, is there some other group, G prime, such that you could say, I'm looking for unitary representations of G prime.
But it was the question for what is the unit, real form of the,
yeah, that's
is
like,
it all G plus 1, comma 1, or is it G plus, comma 2, or is it G plus 1, comma 1? So the first literary real form corresponding to this D plus 1, comma 1. So that's the answer. And all D plus 1, comma 1.
You're saying this is a unitary representation?
Yeah, this
D
is
plus
a unitary representation of all D plus 1, comma 1.
Thank you.
P always P, right? So it's not so obvious.
Yeah, my the key is to false. The matrix in 1.2 plus
1.
Oh. Can we discuss at the end? I find running very quickly. So let me just just very quickly. So for concreteness, let me just state in four dimensions. So the group you can decompose SO4 as SO2 cross SO2 and label representations by two spins of SO2. And so if you do that, you get that the condition is that delta is bigger than f of j1 plus f of j2, where this f of j is equal to j plus 1 or 0. This is for bigger or equal to 1. In other words, just like that. No. In fact, it's more, it's bigger. Only j equals 0. So, but this is just one condition. In principle, you have more conditions. And in particular, for the scalar case, there's a stronger condition that follows from the level 2 positivity of the norm at level 2. So in that case, you can do this exercise of computing the norm of the state P mu P mu. So you contract these indices and act on a scalar operator, okay? So this is just you can do the exercise of commuting this through, and what you get in the end is that the result is, I think it's like 8. The main point is that there's this factor that appears. So if you require this to be bigger or equal to 0, you actually get a stronger constraint on the dimension, the possible dimension of a scalar operator. So the dimension can actually be 0, but if it's 0, that's a isolated point. Then the dimension has to be delta bigger. This isolated point is just the identity operator. So all the other operators have to have dimension bigger than d-2/2. So in fact, you can see just from this calculation that if you take the limiting case, what you get is that this norm is actually 0. So what that's telling you is that p mu acting on this state is 0. So this is like a free, so O is actually like a free massless scalar. So this condition, the saturation of this condition actually implies that the state is a free massless scalar. Okay. So I think this is all I wanted to tell you about unitary representation. So in fact, this condition, the two conditions I derived are in fact sufficient. So she just imposed this, the representation is unitary. And so I want to move on. Let's see. Sorry? No, this is just the identity operator. So now I want to discuss the state operator map.
I guess 0.4. So what's the idea here? So usually in quantum field theory, states and local operators are different objects and more or less unrelated. So in conformal field theory, that's not the case. And there's a very simple way to see that. So suppose you take the metric of RD in a spherical coordinate. Okay? And now you just do, you do a coordinate transformation and write R as e to the tau. Okay? So then your metric just becomes beta squared plus mu max. So here, your space is just RD. And constant R, let's say R equal 1, is spheres, SD minus 1. But now here, you see, because of the original definition of a conformal field theory, you can actually drop this factor, and physics in this matrix is equal to physics in this matrix. But this matrix is just a cylinder, right? So you have a sphere of unit size times some coordinate tau. Okay. And again, R equal 1 corresponds to tau equal 0, and it's again one of these spheres. And now you can think about how would you describe the physics in this picture, right? This picture, you have a cylinder forever and time is going on. So what you need to do to describe this physics, you need to choose initial wave function, okay? So let me write it like that. You need to choose some initial wave function at t equals minus infinity in the infinite path to do your path integral. But you see, under this map, tau equals minus infinity is just this point, R equals 0. So in fact, under this map, what you're doing is that the choice of initial wave function for your path integral corresponds in this picture to a choice of boundary condition at the origin for your path integral on the plane. Okay. But the choice of boundary condition at the origin is equivalent to a choice of a local operator at the origin. Okay. So there's this very precise map between local operators and states in the theory quantized in this geometry, in this cylindrical geometry. Just by the definition that it's a boundary condition, right? It's something you do the path integral all over up to that point. So it's really just a local effect. So that's the definition of a local operator. No? You are, it's almost by definition.
By making this definition, you can mean any boundary.
No, for example, there's this example of toothed loops, for example. Toothed loops is the insertion of an operator that is precisely defined by the boundary condition that you impose on the path integral. You don't actually need to know what to write O in terms of fundamental fields. It's still a local operator. Good. So now that we have this nice picture, let me just say, so of course I was discussing here how generators act on states. So here they will act
by the commutator on local operators. So essentially I'll have the same kind of thing. Let me put a label. they will still be annihilated by. So all these statements translates, all the statements about states translates into statements about local operators. So this is a, these conditions define a primary operator. And descendants are just, you just act with P. But P on local operators is really just a derivative. Acted as a derivative. So these are descendants. Derivatives are descendants. Okay? So it's even simpler in that sense. Descendants is just taking derivatives of local primary operators. Okay. So now I want to discuss the operator product expansion. Where do I go? So, but this picture will be useful still. So what's the operator product expansion? So suppose you have you're computing a correlation function. My pictures of RD. Maybe I should make it bigger. I'm sorry. Now suppose you have insertion, say. Let's say this is operator O1, and let's call this the origin. And now let's put another operator O2 at the point X. And now there is more operator, a generic correlation function. So let's say O3 at point Y, and whatever. So now let's think about doing how the computing this correlation function in the path integral language. Okay. And I want to do the path integral in steps. Okay, so first, I'll draw a sphere centered around the origin. Okay, it's a sphere at d minus one. That includes, so this one is at the center, and this one is at a generic position inside the sphere. And now I want to do the path integral just inside the sphere first. Okay. And then the total result is do the path integral over the full space. So, but I can do it in steps. I'll do it over the sphere. That will define boundary conditions for the rest of the path integral along the surface of the sphere. Okay. So that's what I want to do. Path integral. Inside the sphere. But if you do that, and now you look at this picture, what you're really doing is when you do the path integral all the way up to this sphere, what you're doing is that this sphere maps here to a state at fixed time. Okay? Because boundary conditions for the path integral along a sphere corresponds to a given state, which is also a boundary condition for the path integral for bigger time. So path integral inside SN produces a state. A state, let me call it psi. Okay. But now, in this picture, you can just expand this generic state. So sorry, this state in principle depends on x, right? It was produced by this operator. So the state you produce here depends where you put the operator to. So this state depends on x. But now you can expand it. You can write it in a basis. You can write this state as a sum over some complete basis. Let me call it OI, sum over I, with some coefficients, CI, that depend on x. Right? This is the generic statement in it's a complete set of states. You can always do that in quantum mechanics. But now you see, now these states, now you use again the operator, the state operator map. These states on these spheres, this basis that I choose, is precisely equivalent to each state here corresponds to a local operator here. So this translates into the OPE. So O1 at 0 times O2 at x, it's this producing this state is actually equivalent to just having many operators all inserted at the origin. Okay? So that's basically, you want to do this full path integral. And I'm saying that the part here inside the sphere, you can do this path integral inside the sphere with two operators, is equivalent to a sum where you do the path integral only with operators at the origin. So you replace this by this. And this is actually really an equality. It converges because it's just expressing a state in a basis of states. So it converges, you see. You can do this as long as none of these other insertions is inside this sphere. So that fixes the radius of convergence of this OPE inside a given correlation.
Any questions?
So now I want to refine this OPE because I'm just summing over all states without looking into the symmetry properties. So now I want to be more refined about the structure of the Hilbert space. As we saw, splits into representations of the conformal group. So in fact, what I want to write, instead of writing that generic expansion, is that now I want to split between different types of states. There are states which are primaries, so I'll call this is just over primaries. This sum, okay, and so they will have some OPE coefficients. I didn't say the name, of course. This is a OPE coefficient. They will have some OPE coefficients that depend on x and couple to the primary at the origin, but then there are also other states which are descendants, and that I will include the sum explicitly. So descendants are derivatives of the primaries. Okay, so I'll write it like that. So they have it their own OPE coefficients. And you have an infinite, all possible descendants, and you put more and more and more derivatives. But I'm just breaking up that sum into primaries and descendants. And now the reason to do this is that actually inside these brackets, all these coefficients are almost entirely fixed by symmetry, by conformal symmetry. Okay, so that's what I want to show you now. So to do that, I want to do. So if these operators live in arbitrary, in generic representations of the rotation group, then this becomes a bit cumbersome. But but it's still conceptually it's still the same. So I want to illustrate how it works when these operators are scalars. Okay. So how do you see that? So to see that you use the 3-point function. So consider the 3-point function of O1 at the origin, O2 at X, and say OK at point Y. Okay? So this I want, tomorrow it will be clear, but today I won't explain why, but I'll just state the 3-point function is entirely fixed by conformal symmetry. So it's just its explicit expression is just, so in this case, up to a constant, and I'll call this constant capital C. This is capital, it's different from that one. Okay, so this is a standard result. Most of you know this, but it is true. So now now I want to show you that using this OPE inside this 3-point function and requiring that you recover this result actually fixes all these coefficients. So I want to illustrate how that goes. So first of all, I should tell you another thing about this OPE. So consider, Let me just go back here to this generic OPE, and now consider a dilatation. Okay, consider a dilatation. X goes to lambda x. So these operators, they transform under dilatation as so O I goes to lambda to the minus delta I times OI. Okay. They are eigenstates of dilatation operator. That was just by construction. So that's the way they transform. So if you do this transformation here, what you conclude is that your OPE coefficient have a particular scaling with under this dilatation. So you see, they have to cancel the transformation of the OKs with the derivatives. So they have to transform as delta k plus n. And then there's a transformation on the left-hand side. So they have to transform minus delta 1. Okay? So this is just to show you that this expansion that I wrote down is organized in increasing powers of x. You see, it's a positive power here of lambda. So as you take the small x limit, this limit x goes to zero, all this tower becomes increasingly sublevel. Okay, that's the organization that we are doing here. So it's natural that you do the same here to match that expansion. So let's just try to do that and take the limit delta x much smaller than y. Okay, so think this turns into, so you divide here by y, So this, you got 2 delta k here, and then you got this factor 1. You write this as 1 minus 2 x dot y over y square plus x square over y square. Right, just this part divided by y square, and raised to the other power delta k minus delta 1. Okay, this is just identity, and now okay, now it's a trivial thing to expand this, and you get 1 plus delta 1 plus delta 2 minus delta k over x of y over x square, sorry, over y square plus order x square. Okay, but you see, you could go to any order you want, just a trivial expansion. But now let's then do what I said. Let's use this OPE inside this three-point function. Okay, so what do you get if you do that? Let me do it over here. So you're going to replace the 102 by the OPE. So you get. So first of all, this sum over primaries drops out because there's only the two-point function between different primaries. It's orthogonal. You can make it, it's only non-zero when you have the same primary. You can choose a basis where that happens. So there's only one term in this sum that contributes, okay? So what you get is this sum over n equals 0 to infinity, c k u1 un of x, okay? This is the full expansion. And now you get, you replace inside the three-point function these operators, del of OK at 0 times the other operator, OK at y. Okay? But now this is very easy to compute. This is just a two-point function and derivatives of the two-point function. Okay? So let's just write the first term. So the first term is just, there's no derivative, so it's just a two-point function. The two-point function a k and a k prime? No, I chose, so okay. I can sum over k prime here and put a k prime here, right? But what I'm saying is that this is only non-zero when k is equal to k prime. So I can actually drop this sum and just say k equal to k prime equal to k, right? Because primaries, two-point function between different primaries is zero. You can choose that basis. Okay. So here, k prime equals k only term. No, but so any two-point function between two states in different representations is zero. Because, you see, this two-point function is just derivatives of the two-point function of the primary. You can take these derivatives out. It's really simple. And the two-point function is just, so it's from 0 and y, so it's y to the power 2 delta k that I mentioned. Okay? So this... So even if they appear several times, you can choose a basis in the space of two-point functions that diagonalizes. Okay, so this is the first term. What's the second term? You have another OP coefficient, and now you have the derivative of this guy. Okay, so I think it's 2 delta k. Y nu over and you can go on. And now you just match, and that defines the OP coefficient. So where should I write that? delta functions of the two positions. So here, no, here I'm not taking into account this contact term. Like here, it's just y, and y is not zero.
You can pull them off easily. The truth.
No, but descendants is just to total derivative. Like derivative is nothing already on Bayesian invariant objects. Like derivative of traces of traces. So okay, let me just match CK. The first one then we got. There's this
constant 1 to k, and then the other part is just this x, right? That's the x dependence. X to and let me match the second one then. So again, the same constant. But now we have to match that with the second term in the expansion over there, right? So if I do it right, I think it's going to be. And this is my mu, so this is x mu. Okay, and now you could go on. This procedure you can put in mathematics and gives you all the OP coefficients. But the upshot is that all these OP coefficients are just this constant that is a normalization, not the normalization, the constant appears in the three-point function times some coefficients, I'll call B, which are completely determined by symmetry. So this part is fixed by conformal symmetry. And this part is the only place where where a theory differs from another theory. This is where all the dynamics is encoded. Okay? So it's just in this set of numbers, the three-point function. How much time do I have? Should work. Okay, so now I want to show you this OPE at work in a four-point function. Okay. So where should I go? And that will lead to this notion of conformal blocks. So let's consider the four-point function. And let's use the OPE in these two first operators, okay? So we just did that. So replace this by the OPEs, replace it by a sum over primaries, and then a sum over all descendants. So this n is the level of the descendant. Then there's this OPE coefficient. Sorry, let me, in fact, I prefer to write now that I factorize. Let me use this factorization. So that is a C12k times these b's is reduced to p coefficient mu n of, so now it's x2 minus x1, right? Before the point was at zero, but now I'm doing a generic point here. And now you have your operator. Your operator is just derivatives. Acting on your operator okay at point x1 now, so one is like zero before, and the other two operators that were there. Okay. But now you see already something interesting happening. This is again a 3-point function, which is completely fixed by symmetry. Okay? So you can actually rewrite this as a sum over primaries, and then you have this C12k. And this 3-point function, again, will have a normalization that will be proportional to this CK34. Okay, it's K34, the operators that are there. And now you will have this big sum over all descendants and these coefficients that are fixed by symmetry. Times all these derivatives acting on x1, x1 u1, x1 un, acting on the 3-point function of the primary. But that we just saw what it is. It's just x1, 3, whatever, delta 3 plus delta k minus delta 4, x1, 4, delta k plus delta 4 minus delta 3, x 3, 4. So okay, I should call your attention. This form of the 3-point function is just because I'm choosing k to be a scalar operator, okay? So that's why I can write everything so simple. So this, all this part here, all the x dependence in this 4-point function, all the position dependence is encoded in this function. But this part is completely fixed by symmetry, as you just saw, okay? So these are some building blocks for conformal field theories. I'll call it F, and we chose a channel, so let me write like that. 1, 2, 3, 4, right? We chose to use UP here and then that. And they are a function of the position, 4 points, okay? So these are the what's called the conformal blocks. And again, they are entirely determined by conformal symmetry. They only depend on these labels. Delta I, on the labor of delta I, okay? And now you have this final form of any 4-point function can be written like this, as a sum of this pure number that encodes the dynamics of the theory times some functions that are fixed by conformal symmetry. So this leads to the final constraint that you can use to basically define conformal field theory. So, sorry? No, nothing. So that was just for simplicity. Right, so if k, so there will be contribution, for a generic 4-point function, there will be contributions where this primary k is not a scalar. And then this function will be more complicated. But the same goes true if it's just a unique function. If these are scalars, then there's only a unique function for each of them. So, but the final point now is that there was some freedom
in doing this. Because the OPE is associative, or in other words, there's overlapping radius of convergence. Suppose you have your OPE, your operators are like this. You have O1, and here, say, O2 of X2, and now here you have O3 of X3, and now you have, like, O4 bit further away. So now you can use your, what you've done is to use the OPE here, right? We center the sphere at 1, and we replace these two guys by operators just at 1. Okay, and that gave rise to the four-point function being given by this sum, C1 2k, C3 or CK3 4, times these building blocks, 1 2 3 4, KX1 2X4. But now you can choose. There's another way to use your B. You can, for example, center around this point, make a sphere here, and use the OPE between these two guys to replace these two operators by a sum of operators centered around X3, for example. And you see, for this configuration, there's an overlapping convergence. It's really, you can use at the same time these two B. So that will give rise to something like a sum over the primary states that appear, but now you're doing 2, 3 going to some k, and then k going to 1, 4, and your building block functions will be 2, 3, 1, 4. But now you see, the fact that you can do this in two different ways is a very strong constraint on this number C that encodes the dynamics of the theory. So these functions, you know, you compute by using symmetry, and then you plug it in here, and this sums has to be equivalent.
So usually people draw a picture, I don't know, 1, 2, 3, 4, we represent this side, you will be first here, and then here we give 2, 3, 1, 4. And the fact that these two things are equal is a very strong constraint. It's called crossing equation, crossing symmetry. So okay, so just to finish, let me in fact tell you why our workshop is called Back to the Bootstrap. So the Bootstrap program is actually to use this, like, in the maximal power. So this OPE, suppose you want to compute a generic correlation function, okay? You can use the OPE step by step to reduce, to write the correlation function just in terms of this number, this CIJK, okay? So this number CIJK and the dimension delta I, this set of numbers defines the CFT. So all correlation functions on RD can be computed from the knowledge of these numbers. Okay? So then the idea was to say, okay, then forget about path integrals, forget about canonical quantization or fields or whatever. Just define your theory by this set of numbers, and the only constraint that this number has to satisfy is deltas have to be above this unitarity bounds that we just discussed, and the C's have to be such that they satisfy this equation. Okay. So that would be the Bootstrap program, would be to guess a CFT just from this constraint defined by this. Okay. Thank you very much.
Questions? How much can you go with the bootstrap? Because the most can you go? get some useful data?
No, I think this is this is a very hard problem.
And then some simpler data.
In 2D, there are some examples where you can actually look at, like in minimal models, you can take this kind of approach. Because you have a finite number of primaries, so this becomes a simpler concept. But, well, in 2D, the group is much larger. So what you call conformal blocks there is the contribution to the four-point function of all descendants, all Virasoro descendants of a primary, of a Virasoro primary. It's not, so this is a smaller group that we are dealing with.
The two people you said up there about when you do a dilatation, then you see that the terms in that sum get less and less significant.
Yeah.
And then you had the sum, the two-point function. Not the two-point function, but just two of you said when you do a dilatation, you see that each term gets less significant. I didn't exactly hear what you said.
No, I mean, so this coefficient, so this scaling is telling you that as you increase n, this coefficient gets smaller as a power of x. So when x is, no, what I'm saying is, I just wanted to say that Cn of x is of order x to this power. So when x is very small, all this power gets more and more sublime. It's like a Taylor, it's really like a Taylor expansion. It's just a
very good for the left hand column. And normally it could be analysis, but I think probably